We're glad you're here this morning. Thanks for hanging out at Genesis. For those of you who were at the bonfire last night, I don't know, man, I got the stomach ache from eating too much junk. I don't know about you, but it was a good time. And so I get started this morning. I just want to take a moment to publicly thank Bob and Terry for all the work they do to make that event a reality. That's huge, and they do it all, and it was great to be out there at their house last night. For those of you who missed it, next year you got to come. It's just a fun night. And every year it just seems to fall on a night where there's a big ball game of some sort. You know, either game one of the World Series back in 2006, last night Mizzou, Oklahoma. And, you know, you sit around, watch the ball game, eat, hang out, and, you know, whatever you want to do. But it was a good time. We saw a lot of you there. It was a lot of fun, which is probably the reason a lot of you are already rubbing your eyes this morning. And, I hope he's fast, and we'll see how that goes. It's hot in here, too. At least it is for me. I don't know. I'm always hot, though. So we're starting a new study this morning, a new series that's going to take us probably close to a year. As we look through a gospel, the Gospel of Mark, which is one of the accounts of the life of Jesus. And so kind of before I get into that, every once in a while, about every 4 to 6 months, I think it's important for us to realize that there's always people hanging out in church, that church is kind of a new thing, and the spiritual journey is kind of a new journey for them, and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know about you, but I know that I've been in situations where I was in a church setting, it was awkward because I didn't know what the heck was going on. And one of the most awkward moments is when a pastor goes, "All right, I want you to turn to the book of Nehemiah or book of Song of Solomon or the book of Mark," and it's like everybody in the church is like, they have this ability where wherever he says to go, their Bibles just naturally fall open there, and everybody's reading along, and you're sitting there going, "I don't know where this is. I'm trying to find it. Okay, I give up," because I feel like the big awkward dork in here. And we don't want you to feel that way. We want Genesis to be a really safe place for people to explore faith and just figure things out. And part of the reason we are actually going to do the Gospel of Mark is because if you come here, if you've been here for any period at all, you know that every sermon, eventually, we're going to talk about Jesus. Well, some of us grew up in church, and some of us heard the stories, and we had the flannel graph charts and the Sunday school or whatever it was that you went to where people told us the stories about Jesus. And it may be that your background is, "I've heard these stories, and I know a little bit about him, or I know about Jesus." This would be a good kind of walk through that story again. But some of you have been coming in, like the talks and the discussion about Jesus. You hear us saying who he is, that he's the Son of God, that he is that God became a man and came to hang out with us and all that kind of stuff. But you've never really walked through the story of Jesus. And that's why we're going to walk through a gospel. We're going to spend a better part of a year just focusing on Jesus. We're going to tell you who he was, what he was all about, as we see through the lens of really two men, a guy named Mark, who actually saw through another person that we'll talk about in a few minutes. But before we take off on that, I want to take a moment just to say, okay, how do we look up stuff in the Bible? What does this mean? Where do we find things, okay? And so what I want you to do is I want everybody in here to have a Bible. If you don't have one, if you have your own, that's great. If you don't have one, end of the rows, we have Bibles for you. Pass those down. And I would like everybody in here to have a Bible and to find the table of contents. And if you are grabbing one of our Bibles, the table of contents, like in most books, is going to be, right up front, like the third page in, but find the table of contents in that Bible, okay? All right, so here's the deal. The Bible is actually 66 books that make up one book. The Bible is one big collective work, but it's actually a collection of smaller works that were written by different people in different life situations at different times, different settings, different reasons, different types of literature. And each of these separate books has its own individual name. Often it's named either for the author, the main character, sometimes for the recipients, sometimes just because of what it is, the type of book it is, the purpose. But each book has its own name, and each book is generally distinct from the other books in that it picks up a portion of God telling us about himself from different angles, different perspectives, different ways. Each book was written by men who were flawed, who were broken, who were struggling, who had the same problems you and I do, the same life situations, the same hurts, the same dreams, the same failures, the same successes. And they lived in a cultural setting that was theirs, but as they spoke into their culture, they are revealing the God who is, and that way, because even though it's in culture, it's timeless because the God who is exists at all times, and he still speaks to us today. And so 66 different works, 66 different smaller books. And so when you hear somebody talk about the books of the Bible, you probably went, wait a minute, the Bible's a book. I don't get the books of the Bible. That's what people are talking about. They're talking about these smaller works, okay? So there in your table of contents, you look at it and you will see that these 66 books are actually broken up into two sections, okay? One section is the Old Testament. You see that? Are you with me? You find the Old Testament there at the table of contents. And then you go down a little bit farther underneath it, you will see the New Testament. Well, let me make this really easy. The Old Testament is everything that is before Jesus. It's leading up to Jesus. It's pointing us that saying Jesus is coming. It's going to show us that we live in a broken world that is totally jacked up and totally in need of redemption. And then the promise that God is going to step in and do something about this. He is going to send a deliverer. He is going to come himself ultimately. And the Old Testament is looking forward to him. It tells that story through a people. The people that we would call the Hebrews or the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, they come from one guy, a guy named Abraham, and he has a whole bunch of kids eventually, or you know, one son, but then grandsons and great-grandsons, and they become a nation. And the story's kind of told through their story as God interacts with these people, but it's projecting forward to the coming of a person. The New Testament tells us that Jesus has come, that this one who has been promised for thousands and thousands of years has shown up. And it shows us his life, his ministry, ultimately his death. And then there are several books that come after that that say, now that Jesus has come, how does this relate to us? What does it mean? We live today. And for us, that's 2,000 years after the event. How does this interact with us? Okay, so you see Old and New Testament, and you see books of the Bible. Now, when you ever come to church, you hear somebody say, look up in the Bible, look up this book, look up, Mark chapter 1, verse 1. We'll get there in a minute. Don't look it up yet. What happened is that there were 66 books, but some of these books are really long. In your Bibles, there'll be 40, 50, 60 pages, some of them. And imagine in ancient times when they were on scrolls, okay? And a few people were trying to read along, and the guy would get up and say, okay, we're gonna open the scroll of Isaiah, and I want you to count down to 1,232nd word and pick it up from there. And you'd be like, okay, it'd take 42 minutes for them just to get to the same place. And so about 1,000 years after Jesus, some people came along and said, here's what we need to do. We want to be able to find the scriptures together. We want to all be on the same page. They added what is called chapters and verse headings. And in every book of the Bible, there are chapters and verses. The chapters are the bigger numbers that are larger schools of thought. Sometimes a chapter will be like a whole story or a collection of stories. Sometimes it will be a whole train of thought. But the chapters are the bigger thoughts. And then verses are the smaller chunks that tend to be just a single sentence or a single thought. And so the Bible is now broken up, and it'll be broken up in books, chapters, and verses. That makes sense? So when you're looking up stuff in the Bible and you hear somebody say, look up Mark chapter 1, verse 1, we're going to find the book of Mark. Now, what page is the book of Mark on? And in those Bibles that we gave you? 713. And obviously 1 verse 1 is going to be right there at the very first page, okay? So you go to your table of contents and start looking through that, and you go, okay, I'm going to find Mark 1 verse 1. And Mark is in the Old Testament or New Testament? It's in the New Testament. So that tells us it's after what's happened. Jesus has shown up, okay? The reality of Jesus is not something we're looking forward. The reality of Jesus is something that has happened. And we're going to hear about that, okay? But no matter what book we're looking up, that's how you look it up. So you go to chapter, you go to the book, you chapter verse. Now, what happens though is sometimes you're like, but still, I don't know which books are in the Old Testament or New Testament. So most Bibles, including the ones we hand out, give you another cheat sheet. Flip over to the next page. What do you have there? They're in alphabetical order. So if you're like, when I tell you look up the book of Habakkuk and you're like, I don't know if that's in the Old or New Testament, just flip one page and find the H and then just go there, okay? And, you know, easy way to find chapters and verses. But there's how you use your Bible. And like I said, as you're reading for yourself, you know, kind of read along. You can look up books, chapters, verses, just kind of read through that way. You kind of see trains of thought, schools of thought, that kind of stuff, okay? And so we are going to look at the book of Mark. The book of Mark is in the New Testament. The book of Mark is the story of Jesus coming. It is one of the four accounts of the life of Jesus in the New Testament. And very specifically, we're going to spend a year looking very detailed, very specific way at Jesus, who he was, what he was about, his ministry, his life, all those sorts of things, okay? And Our goal is that by seeing Jesus, we will understand his purpose, his mission. And I really believe when people see Jesus clearly, they will follow him and their lives will be transformed. In fact, ultimately, this book is about what it looks like to follow Jesus. Because the call of Mark is to trust in Jesus and follow, give him our lives. He is the king, we give him our lives. And so how do we know? I mean, a lot of claims, a lot of things are said about Jesus. How do we know? Well, Muhammad Ali was on an airplane once, and y'all know Muhammad Ali, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, and you know, the whole boxing thing, and he kind of had a very high opinion of himself. And he was on an airplane once, and the airplane was about to hit turbulence, so the pilot came on and said, ladies and gentlemen, we are about to hit some turbulence, and I'm going to turn on the fasten seatbelt sign. I'm going to encourage you to go ahead and put your seatbelt on. If you're up and around, go ahead and have a seat and put your seatbelt on. And so everybody sat down putting seatbelts on, but Muhammad Ali did not put a seatbelt on. And so the stewardess walked by him and looked at him and said, Mr. Ali, we really need you to put your seatbelt on. And Muhammad Ali looked at the stewardess and said, ma'am, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And this stewardess was brilliant because she looked right at him and said, Mr. Ali, Superman don't need no airplane. Just the fact that he was riding on an airplane negated who we claim to be, okay? Well, here's what we're going to do. We talk a lot about Jesus. Does he live up to the claim? Does Jesus live up to the hype that we make about him? Jesus has always been the most important figure in history. Every time you data check, every time you call out the date, you're giving testimony that Jesus lived. Every time you kind of think through Western culture, especially our culture, nobody has shaped our the world more than Jesus and those who follow him. All of Western culture has the imprint of the life and ministry of Jesus on it. And we live in a world that he is a central figure, he's a central character, but that doesn't prove anything. And just because he was important doesn't mean that he is necessarily who he claimed to be. Pop culture is also real into Jesus. We live in a world where Jesus is kind of trendy. I was listening to one guy talk about this, and he said about 30 years ago, it was like out of style to be into Jesus. Well, now it's really in style to be into Jesus. And there's all kinds of versions of Jesus and ideas of Jesus. Jesus has shown up on South Park. Jesus has shown up on The Simpsons. Jesus has shown up in the music of Kanye West and Madonna, obviously. And everybody's favorite, at least mine, Jesus showed up in Talladega Nights as the 8-pound, 6-ounce baby Jesus who was wrapped in a golden fleece diaper. People are into Jesus. There's a lot of pop people, people that are in culture who wear the Jesus is my homeboy shirt. People like to throw out the name of Jesus. You win an award at the Grammys, and there are a lot of people walk up and they say, I would just like to thank Jesus. And then they go on to celebrate the music about rape and murder and all that kind of stuff. And what happens so often is that in talking about Jesus, is that we like the idea of spirituality and like the idea of a Jesus, but then we make Jesus into our image. We like a Jesus who's really more like us, and we like a Jesus who gets to affirm who we are without ever pushing us. In fact, if you were to go to www.jesus.com, I think it's jesus.com, you would find out that jesus.com is a pro-homosexual website that is claiming that Jesus was a gay man. And so we turn Jesus into whoever we want him to be, and therefore Jesus affirms who we are. But I was listening to a guy named Tim Keller talk about this, and he said, if you've decided that Jesus is in your image, Jesus never has a right to contradict you. A Jesus who is not over you, who does not have a right to contradict you, will never change you. And he's right. We need a Jesus who will step into our lives and change us. And as we're studying the book of Mark, we're not going to say, hey, what can we make Jesus to be? We're going to ask the question, who is he? Who is Jesus? Because who he is in the story of Mark is who he is today, and what he is up to in Mark is what he is up to today. And as we study this, as we look at this, just chunk by chunk, story by story, teaching by teaching, what we're going to do is we're going to deeply interact with the man who lived 2,000 years ago, but he is more than just a human. He is the Son of God who came to demonstrate and to show us who God is and to rescue us from ourselves. And so as we interact with this, there's two questions that we ought to be asking all the time when we think of any spirituality, but especially Jesus. Who is he? And so what? Who is he? In other words, who is Jesus? Is he who pop culture says? Is he who is Jesus who modern scholarship tries to tell us he is? Or did the gospel writers, the people who wrote about him in the New Testament, get him right? But then here we are today, we live, and it's 2,000 years later, and we have our lives, we have our busyness, we have our problems, we have our struggles. How does a story that's 2,000 years old have anything to do with me today and how I live my life? And Mark is going to help us connect the dots to both of those. And so first thing as we kind of look at this is, who was Jesus? We're going to find out that Jesus was a Galilean peasant who was born in very humble means, and he lived a very normal, humble life. He didn't travel more than about 50 miles from where he grew up. He never held an office. He never wrote any books. He never was a political figure. He never was anybody that had any kind of earthly authority. But more books have been written about him, more songs sung to him, more art painted of him than really all the other people in history. And this man who came demonstrated that he was more than just a human. And so what happened in the story is that Jesus comes and he lives on the earth, and Mark is going to tell us the story, but what happens is he came and he hung out and he lived on the earth, and for the first 30 years or so after the life of Jesus, the people who were his immediate followers, his closest friends, these 12 men that he calls disciples, later calls them apostles. A disciple means a follower. An apostle means one that I'm sending out. So first of all, they're following and learning from Jesus, and then he sends them out to the world. And what happens is that Jesus dies and he rises again. He defeats death, hell, and the grave forever. And then these men are sent out to represent him. And for the first 30 years or so after the life of Jesus, all of the communication about Jesus, all of the preaching, all the stuff happens through oral transmission. As these men pass the story on to others, who pass the story on to others, who pass the story on to others. But about 30 years after the life of Jesus, something starts happening that causes a change that is needed. It's actually, there's two things that start happening. The first thing that starts happening is that there are some competing claims. There are some people who start doing what our culture does, which is they start making Jesus into their own image. They don't want the Jesus that really lived, but they like the idea of Jesus. We're going to reshape Jesus to fit our ideas. That's the first thing. The second thing is that these 12 men who walk with Jesus are getting old and starting to pass away. And the question is, how do we make sure that we pass on Jesus correctly, not just to the next generation, but to us today? They begin to struggle with, we can't just depend on the oral transmission of the disciples who were with Jesus, who Jesus entrusted. They spent 3 years of their life listening to him. He was teaching them, he was training them, he was leading them. We can't now depend on them because they are old, they're about to pass away. How do we make sure that the stories are passed on permanently? And you begin to have some of these core men who were close to Jesus make sure that their words are written down. And we end up with four different people who write from four different perspectives on the same story. As you open the Bible, you'll say, well, there's four gospels. There's the gospel of Matthew, the gospel of Mark, the gospel of Luke, the gospel of John. But what the early church actually believed is that there was one gospel from four perspectives. One story of Jesus. There's not four different versions or four different stories. There's one story, but it's four different people looking at the life of Jesus and proclaiming that to different types of people. And so Matthew is primarily talking to Jewish people, and he tells them that Jesus was the Messiah who showed up that they've been waiting on. John is speaking to thinkers, and he uses a lot of philosophical language, and he begins by at the very beginning, not the beginning of Jesus' life. John begins with the story of creation and tells us Jesus was there. Luke was writing for the purpose of explaining to a single Roman official who Jesus was, and Luke was a historian. He was actually a physician who decided he was going to be a really thorough, detailed historian, and he gives a detailed account that is based on eyewitnesses. But Luke helps us see what's going on. In Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, look at what Luke says about his writing. He says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us. Now watch this. He's saying, people are now saying, we got to write this down. Verse 2. just as those who were from the beginning were eyewitnesses. There's the 12. There were eyewitnesses who were from the beginning and ministers of the word that have delivered them to us. So we had these 12 men and the people that were immediately around them who were with Jesus, who saw Jesus, who heard Jesus, and they've been passing on these stories, but now we have people who are trying to write them down. Verse 3. It seemed good to me also, having followed all these things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. I am now going to write an account of this. Verse 4. That you may have certainty concerning the things you've been taught. This is what the writers of the gospel are trying to do for us. They're trying to say, listen, these men were with Jesus. They were eyewitnesses to his teaching, to his miracles, all this stuff. And Jesus passed this on and then sent them out, but they're at the end of their life. Now we have to get this written down and get it written down accurately so we pass these stories on to the rest of people throughout history. And Luke says, and Mark is going to do the same thing. He says, listen, I went to eyewitnesses. I got this material from the firsthand people who were there. And now I'm passing it on to you. Well, Mark is the shortest, most straightforward, fastest-paced gospel. It's the one, if you were ever to come up to me and say, okay, Mike, I think I need to start reading the Bible. Where should I start? My answer to you would be to start with the Gospel of Mark. Because the Gospel of Mark is written to irreligious people who did not grow up in church, who did not grow up with the Jewish tradition and customs. And Mark is just going to give them a real fast-paced, story-driven version of the life of Jesus to help us understand the core mission and events of his life. He doesn't begin like Luke and Matthew with genealogies and the birth narrative. We pick up Jesus' life when he's about 30 years old. And he just tells the story of when Jesus shows up on the scene and he is shown to be the Son of God by God at his baptism. And we're going to carry that through into up to a really quick account of the resurrection. And Mark is just going to give us a high, fast-paced story version of the life of Jesus. Ultimately, this is important because this is about God's interaction with humanity. And here we are, like I said, here we are, our lives are crazy, busy, hard, broken. The question is, what does that mean to me? Well, to understand that, you got to understand who Mark was writing to. Mark was writing to Romans. He wasn't writing to people who lived like in Israel who'd been around the Jesus story. He was writing to people who were hundreds and hundreds of miles away from this story, and now they're hearing rumblings of this Jewish Galilean peasant who died on a Roman cross, which to them was just despisable. But the story is saying that he rose again. And now there's people popping up who are saying, I follow Jesus. And Romans don't have the background. They grew up in a pluralistic society. They grew up in a place where, you know, there were, all kinds of gods and all kinds of forms of worship. And anytime anybody moved in, they would just add another god to the list. They grew up in the center of power where you know, it was the strongest, most powerful, most influential city in the world. They grew up in a place where leisure and enjoyment was at their fingertips anywhere they wanted to go. They could have leisure with sports. They could have leisure with sex. They could have leisure with alcohol and with partying, anywhere they wanted to go. And in this culture, a few people show up, and Mark is one of them, who are following Jesus. And now his desire is to pass the story on to these Roman primarily irreligious readers to help them understand who Jesus was and why he matters to them, which is why this book works for us. Because the culture that the Romans actually lived in, a lot of historians will tell you that 21st century America, the culture it most looks like in all of history is first century Rome. That our culture is very much like them. Our issues are very much like them. We have all these ideas of spirituality. We have all these ideas of God. And really, at the end of the day, all those ideas of God let us worship ourselves. We live in a fast-paced society where leisure and entertainment and is everywhere. We live in a country that is powerful, that has a lot of influence. And we live in a country that is massively abundant, where we all have quite a bit of wealth, and even when we feel like we're poor, if we look to the other worlds, I was reading this morning on Koinonia from one of our members about the outbreak of cholera in Haiti, where they don't even have access to water, and we take things for granted that are just part of our life that are not even thought of in other parts of the world. Our culture is very much like this. And so the way Jesus speaks to their culture will very much speak to our culture. The way Jesus speaks to them will very much speak to us. And as we walk through this, you're going to find that the things Jesus did, what Mark's trying to say is what he did is what he does. Who he was is who he is. He did show up for a period of life and live on the earth as a human being, but that's not the end of the story. Who he was is who he is, and he still serves us and ministers to us and works in our lives in the same way today as he did then. We may not have him tangibly. Jesus is not going to walk through the back door and say, Mike, all right, nice job, sit down, shut up, I'm going to teach now. We don't have the tangible Jesus, but we do have the presence of Almighty God in the person of Jesus, who still does the same things in the lives of people that he did back then. And so we're going to look through this and figure this out. So our goal this morning, especially this morning, is just to kind of introduce this gospel to you and to kind of get you a feel for what it's about so that you go, all right, I'm in. I'm going to read along with you. I'm going to hear this. I'm going to show up and listen to what this story is about. Because my belief is that as you look at Jesus, you're going to see the beauty of Jesus. You're going to be drawn to him and you're going to want to give him your life. You're going to follow him and that will change you. It will change you for the good. Okay? And so let me talk to you about the title of the sermon this morning is Mark, Peter, Jesus. Okay? We're going to talk to you about three people real quick. The first one is Mark, the writer of the gospel. Who wrote this book? And it's a man named whose name was John Mark in the scriptures. Now, we call it Mark because he gets called Mark primarily because we already have another big character in the Bible named John. And to kind of separate, he is either called Mark or John Mark as we follow his name in the scriptures. But we find, the first time we find out about Mark and very specifically his family, he's probably a teenager. He's probably hanging out. He's got a youth group. He's like a lot of you guys back here sitting here just hanging out who just enjoy playing football in a parking lot. He enjoys, just doing stuff with his friends. He's in middle school or high school, and he's just kind of living his life, but he's living his life in a home where his mama loves God, loves Jesus. And the first time we may meet him, he's naked. There's a story in the Gospel of Mark that a lot of people, they study. It's in Mark chapter 14. It's the Gospel of Mark. As people study this, they say Mark's telling a story, and the story goes like this. At the arrest of Jesus, there is a teenager who snuck out of his house when his mom didn't know it. And he ends up curiously finding where Jesus is hanging out. But then what happens is this band of people come to arrest Jesus. The disciples scatter, and there's one kid left behind, hiding behind a tree, and they see him. And this band of people, when they see him, try to catch him. They grab his shirt, grab his cloak, and he's freaked out, and he starts to run away, and they rip it off him, and he goes streaking through the streets of Jerusalem trying to get back to his house. And a lot of scholars say the only way Mark knows, nobody else knows about the story, nobody else tells it. Mark tells it, he tells it like he doesn't identify the person, but a lot of people think, hey, that might have been him. This might have been Mark, okay? We don't know that for sure, but it's possible that the first time we meet Mark, he's running around the streets naked. But from there, what we do know is that very early in the story of the church, the early followers of Jesus, one of the places that they were meeting was in the home of Mark. In the home, in Acts chapter 12, the disciples are actually gathered together and something really amazing has happened. The main leader of the early Christian movement, Peter, has been arrested. He is imprisoned. They've already executed Herod, the king at the time of the region, has already killed one of the apostles, a man named James. He's beheaded him, and he's going to take Peter down. And so the early Christians are all freaked out. They're already saddened because they've lost one of their friends, and now their leader is, their leader who's after Jesus is now in prison. They don't know what to do, and they gather at a house to pray. The house that they are praying in is the house of Mary, the mother of John Mark. And so the early church, this is probably, what it's probably telling us is that early Christianity, one of the homes that people were meeting in and hanging out and doing life together was in his home. As a young dude, his home was the place the church met. There was a community group meeting in his house, and it was there all the time. And when crisis hit, the whole church gathered there, and they're praying. Well, what happens in the story is as they're praying, God miraculously delivers Peter, opens the doors, and Peter gets out of prison. And he comes, and he's like trying to be all covert and silent. He starts like knocking on the door, and the servant girl in the house comes to answer the door, and she goes, "Who's there?" And they're all afraid that Roman soldiers are going to burst in and take them all. So they're kind of afraid. They're trying to be kind of secretive behind the doors. And Peter's like, "Hey, it's me." And the servant girl, instead of opening a door, goes running in and starts hollering, "Oh my gosh, Peter's at the door, Peter's at the door." And these people who are praying for God to miraculously deliver Peter go, "You're crazy." And they go back to praying, "God, would you please somehow get him out of jail?" He's standing at the door. They're on the inside. "God, would you somehow?" And she's like, no. And so she finally goes, lets him in, and Peter comes in, and they literally see the answer of their prayers right there in the middle of this house. This is the home that he grew up in. Some scholars say there's a very good possibility that not only here, but the home where Jesus did the Last Supper may have been the home of John Mark. And so he grew up in this atmosphere where Jesus was important. Well, a little bit later in the story of the Christianity, John Mark becomes kind of influential. His cousin is a guy named Barnabas, who's a very important person in the book of Acts. The name Barnabas means the son of encouragement. Barnabas is the kind of guy who would build you up, make you feel wonderful, just make you feel blessed. And he's John Mark. Mark is Barnabas' cousin. And Barnabas gets associated with a man named Paul. And Paul, the story of Paul is that Paul makes these three huge missionary journeys across the Asian and European world, and the gospel is spread to the whole world through the ministry of this man named Paul. Well, Barnabas and his younger cousin, John Mark, go on the first story, the first journey. They're hanging out together. They go, and they're going from town to town, but Mark gets homesick, and he abandons them. And he comes back home, and Barnabas goes on, finishes the journey. Well, now they decide they're going to go on a second journey, and Paul and Barnabas are ready to go. But Barnabas goes, "We need to give Mark a second chance." Paul goes, "Nope, the mission is bigger than the person. I can't have this happen again. It broke my heart too much. It made it too hard." And so Paul sees the big picture, but Barnabas cares about the person. And what happens in John Mark's story, this young man's story, is that there's actually a split between these two great men, an argument and a split over the fact that he abandoned. So it kind of lives on in his life for a period. He's got this huge failure that's part of who he is. But about 10 years later, we find that we don't hear anything more about him other than that Barnabas goes one direction, Paul goes another, Barnabas takes John Mark. About 10 years later, we meet John Mark again, and John Mark is now in Rome. And while he's in Rome, he is important to two people. He's important to Paul. Somewhere in that 10-year period, they reconnected, they reinitiated their relationship, and now Paul sees him as somebody that's important to him. But the second person who connects with John Mark is the Apostle Peter, Jesus' closest friend on the earth, or one of the three closest friends that Jesus ever had, and the spokesman for the early church. And in the book of 1 Peter, 1 Peter calls Mark my dear son. He says, "Listen, he's so close to me, he's like my own kid." And so we end up seeing that Peter and Mark are very closely associated with each other. And what happens is either at the end of Jesus' life or Peter's life, or just after Peter died, Mark realized he had to take the writings the words of Peter, all the stories, all the times he'd been walking around and heard Peter stand up in front of a crowd and said, "Listen, I was with him. Let me tell you the story. Let me tell you about Jesus." All the things that Peter had said, he realizes he needed to put it down on paper and pass it on. And so what we actually have in the Gospel of Mark is what the early church father, a man named Justin Martyr, says is the memoirs of Peter. We literally have the words passed on through a younger dude of one of Jesus' closest friends. That's why it matters, okay? In fact, there was another dude who was writing and said, "Where did we get Mark?" And it's a guy named Eusebius who was, he's called the father of church history. He lived around 300 AD, but he's quoting a man named Papias, who's about a 125 AD, who is within a generation or two of the life of Jesus. And he writes, "For the information on these points, we can merely refer our readers to the books themselves." These are the books that Papias wrote. Papias wrote several things. "Now to the extracts already made, we shall add, as being a matter of primary importance, a tradition regarding Mark, who wrote the gospel, which Papias has given in the following words. Now, he's quoting Papias. And the presbyter. So the question is, who's the presbyter? And the short version of that answer is, that is John. Jesus had three closest friends when he was on the earth. Peter, James, and John. And Papias was a disciple of John. John probably led Papias to Jesus, and Papias hung out and learned from him. And he says, John, the apostle John, said this, Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately whatsoever he remembered. It was not, however, in exact order that he related the sayings or deeds of Christ, for he neither heard the Lord nor accompanied him, but afterwards, as I said, he accompanied Peter, who accommodated his instructions to the necessities of his hearers, but who with no intention gave a regular narrative of the Lord's saying, wherefore Mark made no mistake in this writing some things as he remembered them. For of one thing he took especial care, not to omit anything he heard and not to put anything fictitious into the statements. In other words, Papias is saying this is what John said. John wrote an account and he included everything, but Mark's purpose was not to get it in order. He writes thematically. So it's not... This is why as you read Mark and you read like the Gospel of Luke, you'll find two events, but they show up in different places in the book. They don't disagree. Luke is trying to give us more of an orderly account. Mark is writing thematically. So he will pull stories that kind of fit with an idea and a theme and pull them together. And then later when it, so he's not trying to write chronologically, he's writing thematically. That's not a difference, okay? But he says he didn't miss anything, he didn't add anything, and everything he included is right on. So this is what the Papias is saying, just so you hear it again. John said this. One of Jesus' closest friends said, Mark wrote what Peter said. Everything he wrote is accurate. He didn't necessarily put it in order, but he didn't add anything, and everything that he included in his book is dead on. That is pretty good testimony of who wrote this book. And so who is Peter? Well, Peter's this dude who was a fisherman. He hung out with his brother and two of his friends with their father's fishing business in the region of Galilee. They met Jesus maybe even way before the Bible story tells us they did. But at one point in time, Jesus told Peter, Andrew, his brother, James and John, these two friends, to leave their business, to leave their nets, to leave their fishing business and follow him. And they did it. For the next 3 years, Peter walks with Jesus, talks with Jesus, hears about Jesus, gets very close to Jesus. There are several events where Jesus leaves the 12 and just brings three with him. And I told you, Peter, James, and John are with him. And some of the events that we're even going to see show us Peter in this light. And ultimately, Peter has many flaws. He denies Jesus. He makes some huge mistakes. He's got major foot and mouth disease. But ultimately, Peter trusts Jesus, and Jesus changes his life. And after the resurrection, Peter, who denied 3 days earlier Jesus, now has his life totally transformed by the risen Christ. And 50 days after Jesus died on the cross, Peter stands up and begins preaching. He begins to preach that Jesus, who we crucified, is the Messiah. He rose again, and we can trust him. And here's a very interesting kind of thing. I told you that Mark is the memoirs of Peter. The Gospel of Mark follows the same exact outline as a sermon that Peter preaches in Acts chapter 10. It's the same exact outline. We begin in Galilee. Jesus does miracles and does all this stuff in Galilee. Then he heads to Jerusalem and then he dies. It's just that the sermon as it's written in Acts gives the Cliff Notes version, where the Gospel as Mark shares it gives the full, we're going to tell you the whole story version. Same outline though, okay? And so he gets his material from Peter and he writes it down, but it's all about Jesus. It's all about Jesus and who he is. And so if you have a Bible, we already looked up table of contents, go ahead and find Mark chapter 1. Page 713. And look at what he says. Just going to read one verse. I'm going to explain these words and then talk to you a little bit about the order of Mark and how it relates to us. It says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He just jumps right in and says, all right, here's the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So let me unpack these words. First of all, gospel. The word gospel here, like I said, he's writing to Roman readers. It's a word that's actually loaded. We talk about the gospel a lot. We say, listen, the gospel is good news. It is the announcement that Jesus has come. It is a word from the original language that means the pronouncement of good news. But it was used in several contexts. In for a Jewish person, the context was the Old Testament. And in the Old Testament, there are several places where it talks about the coming of good news, the coming of good tidings, and the idea that the king is going to be announced, that God is going to come. This is the world is his kingdom. He is the king over all of it, and he is going to come as the rightful king. And the pronouncement of a king who is going to step in and make a difference in the lives of his people, who is going to transform the world, who is going to change things. Look at it in Isaiah chapter 40 here. It says in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 9 through 11. Get up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald of, there it is, good news. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good news. Lift it up, fear not, behold to the cities of Judah. Behold your God. Behold, the Lord God comes with might. His arm rules for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. In other words, what the writer here of Isaiah is saying is there's going to be a pronouncement. That pronouncement is going to come from Jerusalem. It is going to be a pronouncement of the coming of a king, but it's not just a king. That king is God himself. And the pronouncement, the gospel, the good news is our God has come to us. It's a beautiful pronouncement. It's a pronouncement that these people have been waiting thousands of years to hear, that your God, our God, has stepped in and come to us. But the word also had a very interesting idea in Roman thought too. Romans, when they read this word, they connected it very quickly with the events of their world. Because see, in their world, they had been taught that while there are many gods, there is one who comes to the forefront as the one we worship. And it's the sitting Caesar. And that the idea is that the reigning king, the reigning Caesar, was the one who would bring, every time there's a new Caesar, he would bring a new era, new hope, a new start. He would be the one who would make all things right. He would be the one who would make all things new. And they used this word good news, as this victorious pronouncement of the reign of the new king. It began in 9 BC, just about the time of the birth of Jesus, as the sitting Caesar was a man named Augustus. And they began to use this word to talk about the coming of Caesar Augustus. Well, then they began to have holidays that celebrated the birth of the Caesar and when the Caesar took the throne and when the Caesar did major events, all this kind of stuff. They began to associate all these events with the new king. And these were pronouncements of gospel, of good news. And when Mark says, here it is, the beginning of the gospel, he is saying, there is a king. That king has come. That king is really the one who will initiate a new era. The king is really the one who will make all things right. The king is really the one who will make all things new. The king is really the one who will give us hope, because Augustus died. And then we had a new era, but that era failed too. And now they're in the era of Nero. And the era of Nero is not going good in Rome. There's persecution. Christians specifically are dying at the hands of Nero. He is doing nutty things like taking Christians and putting them on stakes and covering them in tar and setting them on fire and using them as the street lamps of the city. How is that good news? And the answer is because you can endure anything if you know the king has come. The right king, the real king, the one we should really trust. He says the gospel, the good news that God has stepped into history. He is the rightful king. He has showed up. Our lives will make sense and he will make all things right. He will make all things new. He will make it work. He also says, goes on to say, the gospel of Jesus Christ. The name Jesus means God saves. That's the story of the Bible, that God saves. Christ is actually a title. It's not his last name. Jesus Christ was not born to Mary and Joseph Christ, okay? Christ is a title that means Messiah. It's a Greek word for the Hebrew word Messiah. It means the anointed one, the one that God has set his purpose on, that Jesus is the one that has been promised and the one that God has promised as the coming king, the coming Messiah, the coming hope, all the Old Testament prophecies looking forward to him. When we say Jesus is the Christ, we are saying the one the Bible looked forward to in the Old Testament, here he is. Jesus Christ, and then it has an interesting phrase that is the theme phrase for the Gospel of Mark. He says the Son of God. Now, you've heard us talk about Jesus as the Son of God. You've probably heard that language talked about before. But when Mark talks about it, he uses it a totally different way. In fact, The book of Mark is bookended with this phrase. It happens several times throughout the book, but it's bookended. We hear Jesus called the Son of God here, and we hear it on the lips of a Roman centurion at his death. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. In that culture, it was actually dangerous to write this, to say it. Because the Son of God for a Roman, in Roman culture, was Caesar. Was the sitting government, was the sitting God of our culture. And Mark says, no. You understand, you're looking in the wrong place, you're looking in the wrong things, you're looking in the wrong direction to find hope. We need to look to Jesus. He is the true Son of the Most High. He is the God who has come. Who is he? He is the good news, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Why does it matter? Well, the outline of Mark, just real quick, the first, about half of Mark is a story of his ministry in Galilee. And what Jesus does is he begins to heal and serve and love people who are broken, who are hurting, who are struggling, who are suffering in deep ways, the hardness of life, people who are demon oppressed, people who lost loved ones, who have death in their families, who have brokenness everywhere. And Jesus begins to make what is wrong right. And what we see in this story is that these people can't fix themselves. They need somebody from the outside to come in. And the first irony about the king is that the king shows up, and in his ministry as he serves people, we see that Jesus comes and he loves them, he serves them, he changes them, and that the king came to rule through weakness. That it's this weak Galilean peasant who's the true king and who is making the curse and the brokenness in the world right. I know we go crazy. We go to Walmart and they're already putting up Christmas stuff, right? And it's annoying. We're like, all right, seriously. It used to be, can't we wait till Thanksgiving? Now it's like, can't we wait till Halloween at least, you know? Well, I'm going to quote a Christmas song. Joy to the World. In the third verse of Joy to the World, it talks about the fact that no more let thorns infest the ground. And then it talks about how Jesus restores as far as the curse is found. As far as the curse is found. This is the story that he comes and he starts reversing the brokenness in the world. Now, everybody he heals eventually dies. Every time he calms a storm, it's going to rain again. But these are pictures of how God works. He comes into our lives and through the work of ministry of Jesus, he changes us from the inside out. We need somebody from the outside to come do for us what we can't do for ourselves. But then the next thing that we see is that the first section is the ministry of Jesus in Galilee. The next part of the outline and the next section of Mark is that Jesus then has a resolve to go to Jerusalem. And the core issue is that he is going to die for us in our place. And there is the mission of Jesus, that ultimately his purpose was to come to pay a debt that he didn't know. And he is on his way and is resolved to live out the God who is there, to the mission. That God is not far, God has come to be with us. That God is not distant, that God is in our presence. And the mission of God is to come. It's not to stay distant. Every other religion in the world says, God is out there, I'm here, somehow I get to him through whatever it is, you know, good works or prayers or whatever. The story of the Bible is that God's not out there, God has come. We're not alone. He didn't just leave us to ourselves. And he's a God who's on mission, and that mission is to save people. And then the last part of Mark is just gonna tell us that he died on the cross. We're gonna see the story very vividly and very clearly. And that's where we're going. So what? Well, the answer is that hopefully as we look at him, we will want to follow him, because when we see Jesus, we see God. When we see Jesus, we see God. We got a video just to kind of close out this morning. I want you to watch this.